Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up everyone? We've got an amazing TwimmelCon AI Platforms event shaping up for you, and I wanted to share a bit about it. The event is going to be anchored by what we're calling keynote interviews. These are live podcasts recorded right on the main stage, and I'll be joined by some incredible guests. Here are three that I'm really excited about. One, Andrew Ng. I could not be happier to have Andrew kicking off this event with me. Andrew is one of my AI heroes, and no one has done more to bring new practitioners into machine learning and deep learning than he has. Andrew's going to be sharing a bit about what he's learned helping many businesses get productive with machine learning and AI, and also speak with us about where he sees the field going. Number two, Hussein Mahana. Hussein is the head of AI and ML at Cruise, the self-driving car company. Before Cruise, Hussein helped build Google's Cloud ML platform and Facebook's internal FB Learner platform before that. Hussein's going to be sharing some of the lessons he's learned building ML platforms from scratch at some of the most advanced companies in the space. And number three, Fran Bell. Fran leads a team responsible for data science platforms at Uber. These are use case focused ML platforms supporting application areas like forecasting, anomaly detection, NLP and conversational AI, segmentation, and more. Her platforms sit on top of Uber's Michelangelo, putting her in a unique position to speak with us about how low-level and higher-level platforms come together to support data scientists and developer productivity. Beyond keynote interviews like this, we've got a bunch of outstanding speakers lined up to share their successes and failures helping their organizations build and productionalize ML and deep learning models. If this lineup sounds interesting to you, visit twimmelcon.com today to register. Use the coupon code GREATCONTENT through July 31st for an additional 10% off of our special early bird pricing. Hope to see you at TwimmelCon. All right, everyone. I am on the line with Theo Karyanis. Theo is an assistant professor at the Brain Research Institute of the University of Zurich. Theo, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's get started by having you share a little bit about your background. How did you come to work at the intersection of brain science and machine learning?
Yes. So I would say that I haven't had sort of the most direct path in this sort of field. So I started off studying pharmacy, of all things. So I had sort of my bachelor's degree in pharmaceutical sciences and pharmacy. And then I was very, very much interested in sort of my final years in getting into brain science and understanding actually brain physiology and pathology. After that, sort of I decided to pursue a career in neuroscience research, so brain science, through which I've had sort of a decently sort of long trajectory. And after, I would say, establishing my lab here at the University of Zurich about 3 years ago or so, I came to appreciate and came more into sort of contact with the methods that were actually flooding, in fact, every almost field of science and also neuroscience that had to do with deep learning. So that was sort of my first kind of contact with deep learning. Was after I joined the Brain Research Institute and I started working on my own kind of research projects after being a postdoctoral fellow. So I can elaborate more if you want on this or...
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about your research focus?
Yeah, okay. So what I have been working on, and actually I'm very much interested in the lab as well, we're very much focused on understanding how the brain develops. So our primary sort of focus is utilizing animal models, mammalian animal models, more specifically genetically tractable animal model, the mouse, and utilizing that in order to understand how the circuits in the brain get formed, during development, especially postnatal development, so after birth, and how these circuits are modified by experience to allow us to really process information from our environment in an ever-increasing sort of complex and specific manner. So I would say that this is kind of the umbrella field that we were working towards understanding. So basically, one of the sort of the more specific aspects of our work is aimed at understanding how the cortex gets built. So which is this outer surface of the brain, which is kind of supposed to be the most complex and evolutionary newer part of the nervous system. And to understand that, we focus on specific sort of sensory regions in the cortex of the mouse in order to understand how they process information as the animal grows.
Okay. And so does the cortex have, how are the different sensory regions in the cortex organized?
So there's some sort of somatotopy, if you want, in a way, in the sense that they are separated in space. So there's, for example, regions that are devoted to processing visual information, other regions that are devoted to processing somatosensory information, so touch events, and others for other sensory modalities that we have, such as hearing or smelling. So there's sort of, of course, a segregation of these areas, which at some point, of course, further down the information processing kind of converge and come together into a common sort of conscious, if you want, event that can lead to a behavioral output.
Is your research focused on understanding how the kind of connections and pathways are made, or do you see that the neurons kind of physically differentiate so that there are multiple types that kind of interact with one another to produce memory and behavior in these things?
We basically focus quite a bit on understanding a population of cells, neurons in the brain, which are called inhibitory cells, or they have sort of used alternative names, and maybe more sort of correct is GABAergic cells. That take their name from the molecule they use to communicate with one another. So we basically focus a lot on understanding how this second most populous neuronal sort of group in the cortex gets developed, so develops and integrates into the sort of circuit to start parsing out the information that the circuit receives. So I would say that, you know, the lab is sort of focused at multiple levels of analysis, one of which is now going to this a bit more to this sort of brain-wide level, where things need to sort of be quantified at a sort of more complete, if you want, sort of level. So we try to understand a little bit how different areas sort of develop, how inhibitory cells, these cells that inhibit signals and regulate how information flows, are positioned in different areas, how they start function during development, and what that may do for signal propagation. So this is kind of something that we've been focusing on. Of course, there's multiple different types of cells, and the jury is still out as to how many. But our work is sort of a bit focused more on these cells.
And so, how is deep learning come into play in your research in this area?
The way we kind of came about or turned our attention to deep learning is through a couple of projects that we had in mind, where we in fact wanted to address what I was saying earlier, which has to do with a bit more sort of comprehensive understanding of how these populations are, let's say, generated, how they populate different areas, and how they may even sort of cease to exist by a phenomenon which is called cell death. And so in order to be able to achieve that, one needs to create or have the tools at hand that allow them to be able to perform an experiment or have sort of some data at hand, which have to do with actually, let's say, distribution of cells, let's say, based on a specific marker, something that marks the cells that one is interested in, our case, let's say, inhibitory cells, in the whole brain, right? And that way you have sort of, let's say, a section, a tissue that allows you to sort of look at that and take a picture of it. Now, the key question here is how do you analyze that data? And how do you analyze it across different developmental stages? And this is actually how we came about wanting to look into these techniques that are very powerful and are created by multiple labs across the globe that would allow us to basically, first of all, have an atlas that tells us which region is which when we're looking at our tissue. And on top of that, try to extract the signal, which is a cellular signal, so it's a dotted sort of signal, from each one of those brain areas. So this is actually, you know, the reason why we turned our attention to deep learning and machine learning methods that would allow us to basically segment, classify, segment different regions, and also be able to basically pick up, detect the cellular signal that is found within them.
Okay. And so a little bit more about the images that you're using. Are they 3D scans, or are you looking at slices and you need to relate information between slices? Can you tell us a little bit more about the images themselves?
Yes. It actually sort of, we started off by doing sections, so slices. So tissue sections, brain sections. So where we have the whole brain, in fact, but in view, and we just take images. That can be also different modalities. It can be, for example, some bright field images where you detect some chromophore signal that has been created by a chemical reaction, or by fluorescence. So by signal which actually leads to a fluorescent sort of protein signal that you can detect in cells. We have nevertheless also applied these kinds of methods now to different images from different modalities, imaging modalities, such as those taken by a fairly new method that is used in the biological field and also in the neurosciences, which is called clarity or brain clearing. These types of images are generated by the fact that what is done during the processing of the brain, which is after the animal has been sacrificed, is to basically get rid of the lipids and make the brain be transparent, the tissue. And that way you can actually just shine light through it and detect what is evoked in terms of light by means of, again, the fluorescent sort of signal. That way the light is not obstructed to go through, right? So this is another sort of imaging modality that we have used to apply our techniques on. In addition, in the paper actually that was sort of just published, we also tried to benchmark our methods, at least one of the methods we've used, on some sort of MRI scans from human patients, or rather individuals, I'm sorry, that are found on the web in the database. But so although we apply these techniques mainly in mouse tissue, we hope that this method would also sort of start being applied in other types of tissues, in this case, or species like humans.
And so the segmentation that you're trying to do with your method, is it fair to say, is what one might call like a macro level segmentation, like these large regions of the brain, as opposed to clusters of cells within individual brain regions?
Yes. So the initial part was to basically be able to, you're correct, yes, segment a few different brain regions, such as, for example, the cortex, this outer surface that we care about. But the next level of analysis that we are actually aiming at, and we have already implemented parts of, have to do with being able to at least use these deep learning methods to be able to detect all the cells. So in a way, create bounding boxes around them and actually classify them and say with a specific sort of score that these are in fact neurons.
And you mentioned something about seeing or segmenting connections or like signals in these images. Did I interpret that correctly? Are you able to, through the imaging techniques, look at actual communication of neurons?
So we have not actually been sort of dealing with connections per se, in the sense that, you know, these are usually smaller elements and quite complex in nature, depending on how you look at them, that we haven't really kind of dived into yet. Mm-hmm. One of the things we have sort of done a little bit of is look at some really fine grain structures, which are found on cells, which are the sites where connections happen, and try to sort of, in fact, look at maybe how these change a little bit. These are called spines for excitatory cells for these other population of neurons. But in terms of actually looking at, the elements of two, let's say, cells or two neurons connecting, we haven't sort of been looking at that too much. Mm-hmm. What we have done is utilize these methods in combination, though, with other genetic and viral and anatomically, basically, methods that allow us to look at which cells connect to which other cells in the brain, then performing a whole sort of brain mapping of those connections by doing this clarity method that I mentioned before, and then actually analyzing the signal using these deep learning methods. So basically analyzing the regions, maybe types of cells, but also the numbers and density of cells found in those regions using these deep learning algorithms.
Okay, that may have been what I heard earlier that I was trying to tease apart. When you say the cells are connected to one another, is that basically another way of saying cells that are in the same region? Meaning the assumption is all of the cells in the cortex are connected, or all the cells in the hippocampus are connected, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's actually sort of not the case, in the sense that, you know, so the first of the assumptions that the let's say the neurons in a specific area are all connected, or maybe this is kind of the current view, which is not the case. There's a lot of specificity actually in those connections between a variety of different types of cells.
Mm-hmm. So that's not what you're saying.
No, I am actually saying is that through the use of a genetically tractable model, which is the mouse in this case, we and utilizing sort of some complex methods that we can, in fact, go more into, we are able to, let's say, have a type of cell that we care about, understanding what connects to it or revealing. And by tracing those connections in the cells that connect to that cell, not only in that area, but actually across the brain, that allows us to get a full sort of brain-wide view, if you want, of what kinds of areas and also what kinds of potentially cells actually connect with the cells of interest in another given area. Does that make sense?
It does. Let's definitely go a little bit deeper into that. But before we do, you've mentioned a couple of times the genetically trackable mouse. What's the significance of the genetic trackability to your research and what you're describing?
So it's, for us, it's actually very important, and it opens up sort of the door to a number of sort of approaches and questions that are not as easily addressable in different kinds of species, which you cannot sort of, let's say, genetically modify or manipulate. So to give you an example, by modifying the genome of a mouse, you can label specific populations and even types of cells, maybe in specific areas of the brain. Of course, it's not always as clear cut. We can discuss why that is, but it allows us to basically be able to label these cells, track them, across different ages, for example, and also manipulate them. And by manipulation, I mean that you can, for example, remove a gene of interest, such as, let's say, a disease-relevant gene that has been implicated in some sort of a neurodevelopmental disorder, where we know that its expression or its sort of function is reduced. You can basically remove that gene in specific populations and areas and time to understand what it does and how it affects specific circuits. So it is very powerful for us to be able to sort of really be able to track and also manipulate specific populations of cells.
When you say label, you're talking about like inserting protein sequences that you can easily identify?
Yes,
you can. That kind of thing or something else?
Yes, you can do that. You can basically exactly insert, let's say, something which was not present and is not present in the mouse, but which has been in fact shown after multiple sort of control experiments that doesn't have any negative effect on the cell. So this is like, let's say, a small scissors, if you want, protein that acts as a scissors. And then you can combine that with sort of, let's say, a receptive end, right? So you can, let's say, have the points where these scissors can work. You can add them in specific sort of genes in the genome and hence sort of cut them out. Or you can add something on top of it, again, external, which then you can cut out and actually you can cut out one part and let it then fluoresce and let it sort of die, you know, die in the sense of like color the cells. So it's actually sort of there's so many now very sort of interesting tools that have been developed, which by the way, there's also now even cooler tools that have been developed, which allow us to now utilize methods that and species that were not as easily sort of accessible before. One of those is this CRISPR-Cas method that mm-hmm. has been very popular in biology.
Okay, so with these tools in place, now can you talk a little bit more about this process of kind of mapping the connections from one cell around the brain?
Yes. So let me sort of take a step back. So one of the things that the way we've done it, I will try to explain the way we've done it. So we have, let's say, been utilizing some genetically modified animals or mice that, as I said, express these scissors in specific cell populations that we care to study. A specific interneuron type or inhibitory type in the brain and the cortex. By having the scissors cut out a stop signal, if you want, they allow something else to come online. And that something else that comes online, like a set of proteins, are in fact then expressed or presented in the cell types that we care to study. One of those things that is expressed is actually a receptor, so something which can go to the membrane of the cell, the outer sort of part of the cell, and that has specific things that it binds to. So this is a protein that is not found in mice, so it's actually found in birds, hence we know that then it should be specific for these cell types. Now, what we do is we, at the same time, utilize genetically modified viruses. So in the neurosciences, viruses have been used for quite some time now in order to be able to, for example, express certain things, let's say, again, a colorful thing, that once you put it in a specific area, then you can actually have this virus be taken up by the cells. And then you actually see the cells and all of their processes labeled. Therefore, you can follow them in different areas and different brain regions. Now, this has actually been even more now modified, and even more sort of tools have been created to now be able to label specific populations of cells, such as the ones I was describing. So by putting a modified rabies virus in this case, the rabies virus, we can discuss what it is, but it's a different kind of, it's a specific type of virus, you're able to infect the cells that you want, because the virus now is red, right? Because you have expressed a dye in there, a colorful dye, it can actually label the cells that you care to label, and it can also label the cells that connect to that cell. And so I hope sort of I explained it simply enough, but not simplified, I didn't simplify too much, or it wasn't sort of too complex, but basically by utilizing different sets of tools, which have to do with the mouse lines and also the different viruses again, we're able to, in fact, look at connections on specific cell types.
That is super fascinating. And now I've kind of pushed you down into the biology here, which is very, very interesting. With this particular problem of the connections, is this a place that you're applying deep learning as well?
Yeah, so far,
I'm really glad you said yes.
Yes. What we have sort of been applying deep learning methods for in these cases are to be able to, to look at, for example, the distribution of the connections, right? So let's say you want to assess a brain area A and what connects to cell type A. And so you utilize the methods I mentioned, and then you want to understand, because you almost go with an unbiased approach, right? So you say, okay, where do these cells receive information from which areas and which cell type? So in order to do that, again, in a brain-wide manner, you need to put in place methods that don't force you to actually do typical stereology, that you start counting and extrapolating, or in fact, you know, make you count every single cell and try to eyeball the region that these cells sit in. So we try to utilize these deep learning methods to, first of all, identify brain regions in a whole brain sort of imaging set, as I said, with clarity and light sheet microscopy. And then once we have identified the region and segmented, let's say, the region, then we actually use a different algorithm to actually detect all the cells in that region.
And so can you talk about the specifics of the deep learning that you've used to accomplish these tasks?
Yes. So in this case, I would say that we're kind of like the end user here and on the application side. So the kinds of networks we're utilizing are actually being currently developed by outside the lab, and they're being published by a number of labs. In this case, by, for example, Facebook or Google. And we basically took inspiration from the excellent results that they have, in fact, seen in life, basically, you know, images of humans or cars or any sort of basically external sort of scene that allows us to basically, again, segment and call an object of a specific type, and also count cells. So the two methods that we have utilized, actually adapted, I would say, for our methods, are two networks which are called FastRCNN and MaskRCNN. And these sort of were developed by the MaskRCNN specifically, which we utilized in the published work, was basically developed by Facebook AI research.
Got it. And did you evaluate a broad array of different methods or algorithms, or start there and it seemed to work well, so you moved on?
Yeah, so our primary purpose obviously was not to kind of do like an end-to-end comparison with all the methods that are out there, because we're also not primarily a lab that develops these kinds of techniques or puts a significant effort in into this field. So I would say that we basically looked out there to see what's available, what's the most common sort of way that people do this kind of, in this case, image registration to an atlas. That we benchmarked our method against, which these are not deep learning algorithms, But of course, there's a sort of other efforts that have been also done by other labs, of course, that were sort of generating methods to do these kinds of things. But I would say these efforts have focused on mainly human brain images.
What did you learn as you were applying these methods like MaskRCNN to this problem? Any particular, you know, interesting challenge or observations in terms of applying it to the types of images and objects that you were looking for?
One of the sort of things that I came to appreciate is actually, of course, the power of these methods. When you sort of have at least a large enough sort of training data set to be able then to look at the, testing data set and actually perform the job. But in terms of our sort of method, I would say, or our sort of questions, I would say that, first of all, we didn't try to do this for all the brain regions. We actually chose a few brain regions to kind of showcase the ability of the method to perform well and the usability of the method. But I would say that, of course, structures change in the brain when you move to different sort of, parts of the axis, right? So you may have the same brain region, the cortex or the hippocampus. But as you go and take images of that region at different basically levels, right? Closer, let's say, to the midline or farther away from it, then the network is having a challenge in basically being able to detect, of course, more complex types of imaging brain regions, right? And so I would say that the network has performed well enough for us to actually make use of it, but there's quite some way that we have to go in order to make sure that it's even more accurate and that it's actually able to segment sort of this harder type of regions, which are maybe not as sort of easy, and also expanded in other brain areas and even more specific parts of a given brain area. So we're at the very beginning of these efforts.
And what were some of the alternative or traditional techniques that you were benchmarking these methods against?
So two of the sort of most commonly used methods are Elastics and ND-REG. So these are basically non-deep learning algorithms where, they take minimum type of error approaches and utilize linear or non-linear sort of warping of the atlases onto images that you have collected. So these are the two sort of most commonly used, and we kind of try to utilize those ones to just initially at least. And then we try to take it one step further and utilize or compare against some other methods, which were basically out there published on sort of some human, in fact, issue, again, that was on the web, it wasn't generated by us. So yeah, I would say that this is, it is not, of course, clear whether at the moment this is the best deep learning algorithm to be able to segment different brain regions, because, of course, this field is moving very fast. And, it is not unlikely that other algorithms are in the making, or in fact, were just, published that could even sort of surpass this algorithm we've used.
Were there any particular challenges that you faced in the kind of the data management and preparation side of this project?
Yes, I would say that, of course, with any of these methods, as a sort of novice in the field, I've come to appreciate the amount of effort that needs to be put in terms of generating the ground truth data set. And so that has been sort of course, a bit of a bottleneck for us, being able to really kind of create this data that we use to train the network. Yeah, I would say this has been sort of the biggest challenge for us, if you want, in sort of doing this. Because we were, in fact, lucky enough maybe sort of inspired enough, I would say, to also have access or gain access to a big data set, which is available to us and actually the whole neuroscience or brain science community, provided by the Allen Institute based in Seattle. This has been an institute that has been generating a lot of data at different levels of analysis, including a lot of sort of images of mouse brains for different types of proteins and markers and so on and so forth that mark different areas, different sort of cell types and so on and so forth. So this was also sort of a great resource for us to have. And so we tried to utilize it, abundantly in order to sort of get to our goal.
And so what's next for you and your lab in terms of applications of machine learning and deep learning?
So what's next for the lab is actually one of the things that we would like to try to do is to expand on these approaches to both anatomical type of data, but also potentially sort of some functional data, meaning some activity type of data that we collect and others on live animals awake or freely behaving or basically that have undergone some sort of like external stimulus presentation. So I would say that for now, we're aiming to expand some of these methods to potentially include other areas, but even more so to include hopefully different sub-regions within regions, right? Where we then need to create even sort of different types of ground truth, of course, that will give us quite a bit more specificity in terms of understanding actually this at the brain-wide level or at least cortical-wide level. So I would say that would be sort of one direction that we're going towards and trying to also sort of utilize maybe these methods to look at connectivity that you asked me before a bit more directly if possible, as well as try to implement these methods in functional data, as I said, that are collected by methods that look at activity of neurons in vivo, so in the live sort of animal.
Well, Theo, thanks so much for taking the time to share a bit of what you're working on.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on today's show, visit TwimmelAI.com/shows. Make sure you head over to TwimmelCon.com to learn more about the TwimmelCon AI Platforms Conference. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.